Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm Ailey Packer and we just don't know where to draw the line in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Well then, where do we start with this one? Radio guidelines prevent me from unleashing some prime Anglo-Saxon, but I'm pretty sure you could fill in the blanks. In truth, I think we all could have predicted how last Saturday's game at Palace was going to unfold, and we have in the past had many perfectly good goals ruled out by the officials. But this is a new low for PGMO and the Joy Stealers at Stockley Park. We all know that had Alexis McAllister bought his shooting boots, or had we finished off more than just one of our 17 shots on goal, or had Robert Sanchez not played dropsy, then we would be having a very different conversation. But the VAR John Brooks' inability to use the technology correctly in ruling out Purvis Estupiñán's perfectly good goal probably cost us all 3 points. But we did manage to maintain our unbeaten start to the season. But that record could be severely put to the test as this season's surprise package Fulham, who we have never beaten in the top flight, visit the Amex. It was a painful watch at Craven Cottage in August in Graham Potter's last away game in charge. Let's hope we have a better outcome under Roberto De Zerbi. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we are delighted to welcome back Jason Thackeray, and we're also always delighted to welcome Andy Bass. That doesn't mean we're not always delighted to welcome you, by the way, Jason, but you know what I mean. Well, I mean, guys, I mean, it's the one topic that's been bugging us all week, for sure. Where do we start with this, Andrew Bass?
It's just incredibly frustrating. Incredibly frustrating day on Saturday, basically. I think in terms of my match day experience, it's actually a lot more pleasant than it has been in recent years. So not actually such a bad day off the pitch, but on the pitch, it was the same old, same old. My gut instinct before the game was that there would only be two goals in it, and it would either be 1-1 or 2-0 to the Albion. I wish I'd gone with my gut on the Supporters Club quiz because I actually predicted a 3-1 victory. But, I just think anybody who put money on 1-1 would have just could have just printed their own money, I think. An utterly predictable debacle of injustice yet again, where we dominate a game and fail to beat them. It's just getting beyond a joke now, to be honest. It's just like I'm almost resigned to it. I've kind of made my peace with it now a couple of days in. But really, if I was Crystal Palace, I would be very wary of the Ides of March, particularly those of the
nicely done. On the nicely 16th, done.
Because I think we are going to remedy what happened on the injustice of Saturday. I think we'll beat them.
Jason, like I said in the intro, I mean, this isn't the first time that officials have made a mistake, right? But this is this one is just preposterous.
Yeah, it's absolutely insane, and I just can't understand how it happens. I mean, the argument we've had loads of arguments about VAR since it's come in about, you know, will it improve the game and does it stop you celebrating a goal and will we get less injustice and will it be better and when you get less top six decisions and all of that stuff. They can't even draw the line on the right player. So it's astonishing. And I came back, I went to the toilet at half time and came back to my son who was on his phone. He went, they drew the line on the wrong player. It was a goal. 16-year-old boy noticed it at half time from a still. I mean, it's just absolutely incomprehensible.
If you're asking, what do you take from the game? I mean, obviously, that is the main talking point. And unpopular opinion, but probably true fact, VAR has probably corrected more incorrections than it's got horrifically wrong. I mean, sometimes there is a case where the ref will get it wrong and then VAR will get it wrong, thinking of the Harry Kane one with Lallana. But this was a correct decision that was made wrong. I mean, in this instance, the referee and linesman effectively have little to no blame on this, because the nature of what's gone on here is entirely down to Stockley Park. But if you're going to say what you're going to take from the game as a whole, it's the fact that there is hardly any teams now, and I include some of the bigger ones, with whom we cannot completely and utterly boss possession. At the end of the day, that has very little meaning if you don't stick your chances away. But I think we learned something that, irrespective of who we're playing or even how we're playing, the other side is going to find it hard to get the ball off us. So in that sense, I actually saw, believe it or not, a progression in De Zerbi's play. And the fact is, we did get through them. I mean, Bournemouth was a tough game, but we did get through them. We did get round them and eventually scored a winner. We did that with Palace, didn't get round to doing it. Although, you know, to the strict laws of the game, yes, we would have done. And maybe once we'd have got two, who knows, we'd have got three and four. Who knows? However, VAR, what a farce. There is no excusing it. An apology is kind of empty. I'm not going to go down the same road as Mikel Arteta. Who,
I don't know what Arteta said. So what did he actually say?
He's demanding 2 points back. After Brentford were arguably wrongly given a goal to equalise, for which then Arsenal did not go on and score a winner. I mean, if you're going to criticise anyone, yeah, we conceded one goal and didn't win. But, you know, it's win and lose as a team. So, you know, it's incumbent on the others at the other end to score the goals. He demands that Arsenal get 2 points, the extra 2 points, because it was wrongly given. And if De Zerbi came up with that, I'd be sort of mortally embarrassed. Yeah. So,
but, I mean, is there a precedent for a replay? I mean,
nope,
I think
none whatsoever.
No.
No.
Okay.
No,
okay, because I mean, there was this, obviously there was the Sheffield United incident a few years ago. Well, a very few years.
But that wasn't a VAR decision. That was actually that was down to Arsene Wenger offering. I think it was Neil Warnock was in charge at the time of Sheffield United. I could be wrong, but he was offering it by way of sportsmanship. There was no way that the FA were going to intervene. But they did approve Arsene Wenger's offer. But above and beyond that, there is nothing in the laws that says that that is what's happened.
Okay. Are we? Oh, I mean, I don't really want to spend too much time on this, but
if you do,
I mean, is there an argument that VAR got another decision wrong in this game, Al?
Not necessarily. If we're talking about Alexis McAllister's early lunge, for which he got a yellow card, and again something which can't be re-sanctioned later. If it had been yellow. I think it's one of those that, did the referee make a clear and obvious error? The answer is probably, but probably isn't the same as yes.
I mean, we have seen instances like this where something like that has happened, Andy, and the ref has gone to have a look at the monitor.
That was not anywhere near a red card. I don't know what the fuss is about, to be honest.
If we're saying the one that Fabinho was a red card, then
there was no force used in that challenge. McAllister was off balance and was stretching for the ball, and he caught the guy on the shin pad. Admittedly, his studs was up, so when you look at the still photograph, it looks bad, but he wasn't trying to kick him. It was a clumsy challenge for the ball. The Fabinho one was completely different because he had absolutely zero chance of getting the ball, and he scraped down the back of the Ferguson's leg. That's completely different. I don't. There was a good reason it wasn't included in the Match of the Day highlights. It was just like nothing. I don't even know why we're discussing it, to be honest.
No, I disagree. I think if it had been given as a red, I don't think the Albion would have had too many complaints. It was clumsy, if that was a red.
Absolutely.
It was studs up. It was dangerous. It was a potential leg breaker. The amount of force isn't the point. Even the intent isn't the point.
I've got to disagree, Al, because it wasn't dangerous. That's why it wasn't a red. It wasn't. There was no force in it. He made contact, but he did not pile in.
Have you been looking on
dangerous? So that's why it wasn't a red card. If it had flown in, But the knockout one from a cup from 3 years ago, then yeah, that easily could have been a red because that was reckless. That wasn't a reckless challenge by McAllister. You're simply judging it on the fact that the studs were up and it hit his shin pad. But he barely made contact. It wasn't it was not dangerous play. It was quite an easy call to say it wasn't dangerous.
Yeah. I like it to McTominay's challenge actually. So sorry, Jace. Yeah, go on.
I'm with Andy 100%. There's never a red.
Okay. Well, I mean, funnily enough, I mean, we were all hoping that in a similar way to the Andy Knockart situation, who went on to score an absolute pearler in that game, we were hoping that that McAllister would actually repeat that particular thing. And actually, on another day, he probably should have been going home with the match ball. And in fact, all I've got that written down in my notes repeatedly is McAllister should have scored.
I think that the header was really the egregious miss from him. It was a free header right near the end of the game. And that was the clearest opportunity for him to score. And to be honest, I thought it was in. We were all jumping up and celebrating until we realised it had gone past the post. But yeah, it was a curious performance from McAllister. He found himself in some, reassuringly, he found himself in some very good positions to score. He was pushed further up the pitch and he did get into good positions. So I'm quite pleased about that. He'll be disappointed with the execution of the chances that he had. I thought the first one he had right at the beginning of the game, he just clearly underhit it, and I just thought, well, that was a bit weak.
I've got powder puff written down here.
Yeah, the powder puff is a good word because that was a relatively comfortable save for.
I was thinking about this sort of after the game and leading up to thinking what we're going to talk about today. And I do wonder whether there is an element of it was De Zerbi's first derby. It's been sort of hyped up because we haven't played Palace in the first half of the season, so that's been building as well. Whether there was just an element of it meaning something to McAllister and him just not quite having that normal composure that he's got because then it snowballs. So he gets away with the tackle. Well, he doesn't get away with the tackle because it was a yellow, but it's a yellow and he's getting screamed at for a red.
Yeah,
well. Then he underhits his first one. Then he misses the next one. And it showed right up to that volley that he had at the end where he just cushioned it into the keeper's arms. Yeah. It just didn't quite seem to be the same level of composure he normally has.
Well, McAllister has scored at Selhurst before, don't forget, and a very important goal it was as well.
Yeah, but it was behind closed doors and it wasn't De Zerbi and he hadn't just won the World Cup.
And that's why I think, actually, I think you probably just answered your point there. That's why I don't think it's anything to do with that, because this is a World Cup one and he knows better. You know, this is a bloke who under, you know... Do any of the Brighton players play under pressure? Don't forget, half that side have never played in a Palace-Brighton rivalry match before. So... what actually worried me most was, and I've seen it in a couple of the South Americans, let's not try and be too stereotypical here, but there's one or two South Americans I've seen, especially playing in the under-21s, where they can get a bit heated. And in a derby game, it can get a bit naughty. Having said that, in this game, it wasn't a particularly dirty game as such. But, you know, it doesn't take much, especially if Zaha had been playing. And here's the Trollmeister. If he had been playing, then you can actually sort of see one or two of the South American lads getting a bit feisty. But in the great scheme of things, it was attack against defence, where attack just couldn't do its job.
Well, you know what they needed to do, Al?
What do they need to do, Aid?
They needed to channel the energy that got them there. That's what they needed to do.
I could not believe that the Always Ultras, copyright Vicky Rees, could... could actually come up with such a... It's like a bunch of reprobates have gone on a corporate jolly, on a corporate day out, with a blue sky thinking. Basically, the sort of thing that you're doing at the moment, Jason, where you're in a hotel in Cardiff, just about to go and see a client, and this you've got to sell this client about channeling the energy. I mean, you're working in an office at the moment, Jay, so tell us about these corporate days out where you're supposed to really get these sort of these positive vibes from working.
Well, what they do, Al, is they lay out a large bed sheet and then they get you to write something completely inane on it in felt tip and you can show it off to everyone.
Yeah. And what have you written
and
on
that's it.
Before?
What have I done on it? I don't do many of the... I'm not super powerful enough to do these corporate away days. I did one years ago that was building stuff and climbing up rocks and it was quite good fun.
And you had to punch a shark or something.
So it wasn't like a playground thing from the thick of it or anything like that?
No, I avoid those like the plague. I tend to book days leave for those.
All right, well, this is what happens when the Always Ultras go on one of those days and they come up with this tinsel-flavoured... What was the phrase? Channel your...
Channel the energy that got us here, I think it was.
That's exactly what it was, channel the
I
energy.
I actually thought it was
here.
A message to people coming across on small boats from Calais.
different channel.
I found that message particularly ironic given that Palace fans have been criticising their team for actually being quite lazy this season. And it's quite interesting looking at the stats that Palace only had 240 passes compared to our 705. I'm thinking there's not a lot of energy for them to channel. I mean, this just adds to the frustration of the day, really. I just don't think that Palace offered anything in that game. I described them as a disheartened, dishevelled monument to mediocrity in a WhatsApp thread with some other Albion fans.
See, that's a better banner.
And and that would have been more accurate, I think. Yeah. Or yeah. You know, to describe.
Sorry, AD. What was that phrase again, Andy?
Disheartened, dishevelled monument to mediocrity.
Right, put that on a plinth.
The thing I was going to ask Jason was, though, I mean, if you put yourself in the Palace fan shoes, right, you're playing at home against your biggest rivals and you play for a draw from the first whistle. And it's, I mean, admittedly, their shape was, it did have me confused. The fact that they were so narrow, particularly when we've got likes of Matoma and March on Fire. And like, why are you giving us the wings? But I mean, they did pretty much nullify Matoma, but they had no ambition at all.
No, they had zero ambition. And I put this on a post on North Sound Chat that evening or the day after. They were happy to take a point. They were time-wasting from early on. They looked very devoid of ideas. Without Zaha, there wasn't anyone there that really had the passion for the game either. You just imagine turning up there week after week to that ground with guys with pom-poms and a bed sheet and watching that. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Like, can I just point out the lovely glitter work on that bed sheet?
It was... I did mention it. Ada, can I just answer your question? I think you might have even answered it within your question. Is you were sort of accusing Palace of playing fairly narrow. I could actually understand that as a legitimate tactic because you said, you know, they were conceding the ground of for March and for Matoma. I think it's probably because they wanted to fight the battles they knew they could win. And if they did try and actually put up a battle of putting two or three on March or two or three on Matoma, then you're going to concede so much more in the middle. So it's like they conceded that ground out wide. Now, admittedly, certainly in the first half, Matoma was actually fairly effective. In the second half, he barely got a kick in comparison. Whereas they basically let March have the run of that, what I would say far side, is near side for the Albion supporters. And so therefore, and I'll put this to Jason and to Andy in a second, that I think that for me, Solly March was Albion's man of the match. But they let us have that and then defended with the hope of a breakaway goal. And the assumption that some of our passes may or may not go astray. Andy, Jason, who was your best Albion player on at Selhurst?
Mine was actually Purvis Estupiñán, but it was between him and Solly. I thought they stood out. I also thought Caicedo had an absolutely terrific game, and I thought him and Pascal Gross were just like running on empty at the end. I really thought. Deserbi might bring one of them off just for some fresh legs, but I just think that the effort that they have put in, they kind of earned to stay on the pitch for the entire game. But yeah, you're right. Solly was absolutely exceptional again, and I don't have a problem with him being described man of the match. For me, it's like, you know, nine out of ten against 9.5 out of 10. Really, to be honest, between those two, I thought they were
Jace?
Both great.
Yeah, so exactly the same as Andy. I was flipping up between Estupiñán and March. I would have been happy with either. I would say March had Tyrique Mitchell on toast. He was absolutely terrified of him. He was being skinned every time Solly went inside. And where did the goal come from? You talk about them conceding the wings. Okay, Mitoma didn't do it, but we were right out wide on the left-hand side. Great cross from Purvis. And March getting ahead of Mitchell, and those two. It was a good team performance, but those two.
Purvis is now second for assists this season. Who's first? Any ideas?
Solly March.
It is Solly March. Yeah.
See, this is another point that we've been saying quite a bit on the show about the team that we've got, that Mitoma usually operates best when he's got Estupiñán sort of working alongside him. Solly March has got to contend with it being Lamptey or Veltman. But with Estupiñán and Mitoma on the other side, they do have this kind of near telepathic link up. So when they probably not unreasonably have focused on Mitoma to try and close him down, they can't close Mitoma and Estupiñán without completely overloading that side. So one or the other is always going to have some fun. And I think that might be set the thing for future games, is that unless a side can actually overload one side and then quickly overload the other side, if we've got the same issue on the other side, is if Mitoma has a quiet game, Estupiñán will have a stormer and vice versa. That's not to say they can't both have a stormer, but it's going to be very rare when both of them are quiet.
I found it very interesting on the Albion website today, Matoma's comments about his performance, because obviously he was quiet. So he was like a hyped up player before the game. And as you say, Al, I mean, it's like, you know, Matoma was quiet, but it meant that other people could sing. So, it was great. But I think he was disappointed, but he goes on. He said, on Saturday, I thought the opponents would get tired as time went by and more space would open up. But that wasn't the case. But I should try and receive the ball in a better situation myself. Already, it shows that he's now learning how he's going. He's already thinking about how to counteract the fact that people are counteracting him now. And I know people have gone on about, you know, he's done his university dissertation in dribbling, but that shows the mindset and the way that, you know, obviously he's had a very successful start to the season, but now people have got the film, they've seen him, they're going to develop plans for him, and now he's developing plans for them, making plans for him. I just he's approaching this whole thing.
Well, this is what Carew actually said. It was when he was asked if he thinks the opposition are stalling his style of play. Mitoma said, "Maybe there are less players who come directly towards me to rob the ball. More often now, they block the vertical lane and try and force me to cut inside. I was able to deliver in that type of play, but I would like to focus especially on breaking through vertically and getting in a cross. And then the quality of the cross is also important."
So, is Dr. Dribble the new computer?
I think he is. I mean, it's really interesting. And the thing was, it didn't matter that they kind of done a job on Mitoma, because it meant March had much freer rein. Purvis was still able to wreak havoc, and unsurprisingly, it was Purvis and Solly that were able to combine for the goal. And so, I'm sure Carew was disappointed with his own personal contribution, but the fact that they had to shut him down meant that other players could make that contribution for him. And it just shows that we are a difficult team to defend. I mean, what we have to do is take the opportunities that we create because of that. And we failed to do so on Saturday, unfortunately.
I mean, Jason, do you think that Purvis has flown under the radar a little bit?
In terms of other teams wanting to pick him up already, or in terms of our own fans? Because I think he's very appreciative.
Both, really.
Yeah, I mean, he's only been with us half a season, so I wouldn't expect other teams to be trying to poach him yet, but they might well have a go in the summer.
Cucurella?
I mean, he's an upgrade on Cucurella, so, you know, why wouldn't you? I was quite worried when we sold Cucurella because I couldn't see who we'd get in to replace him. We've got someone who was, I think we did our homework and found out he was the most similar to Cucurella in several statistical aspects. He's actually been better, I think, this season. So he's not under the radar for me or a lot of other Albion fans. And I'm sure there are teams looking at us right now and just saying, which one of these superstars do we get? We've got a lot of really good players at the moment. We're not going to sell all of them.
I think there's a parallel line here between Cucurella and Estupiñán. Now, whether you're looking at one being better than the other or not, I'm not sure. But I would actually say, as much as we love Estupiñán, I think there's been an element of the fact that he did struggle a little bit with the pace and the toughness of the Premier League in the same way that Cucurella did. Now, don't get me wrong, he didn't get smashed with an elbow in his first 10 minutes. But, you know, it's a case of getting used to the culture. There was a couple of times he was diving where Cucurella was doing so. There was a couple of times he was being caught out because he wasn't quite the pace of it. Now, he's probably made to look better because I think he has a slightly different role. And I think this is the important point, he has Mitoma ahead of him. Don't get me wrong. Cucurella having Trossard ahead of him was good, but give me the option of Cucurella and Trossard versus Mitoma and Estupiñán, you know where my loyalties are going to lie. So I think that the pair of them make each other look so much better. But it's kind of an interesting point. So if, huge if, Chelsea do come sniffing at the end of the season, 62 million is going to seem like loose change if they really want to get Purvis out of our pockets.
I really don't think that Purvis will be on Chelsea's radar.
I don't think so either.
Which is kind of the point I was trying to make, because, you know, I mean, you know, we have got players that garnering column inches all over the place. You know, obviously McAllister's gone and won the World Cup. Mitoma is just like skinning everybody alive. Solly's just managed to work out how to put the ball in the back of the net. You know, we've had Caicedo and the transfer saga. I mean, but no one's really been talking about Estupiñán. And he's been just quietly going about his own business. And I'm still maintaining, and I've said this to you, Andy, many times, that I think he's actually the best crosser of the ball at the club.
I wouldn't disagree.
I agree.
He had one man to pick out for Solly's goal, and he found him. I mean, there was nobody else in there, but he knew what he was doing when he put that ball in. He absolutely put a whip on it and March read it before the defender and was able to just get in there and just put it away from like a couple of yards out. Absolutely just quality. I mean, it was quality that, you know, the pedestrian opponent just could not cope with, and it was a quality that they lacked. I didn't see anything, from them. They only had one really good out chance from like regular play, and that was immediately after our goal had been disallowed, when Webster put in a fantastic block on Mateta.
Webster did,
but that was it. That was it from them, as far as the attacking force was concerned.
And back to Estupiñán. I mean, what we haven't really talked about is irrespective of what VAR have done for his first goal, let's celebrate what should have been a very legitimate and very well taken goal. You know, there he was, put into space, no Palace player near him. They had again fallen asleep. And at the time, even though we in the press box were at that end, I thought he had taken a deflection. I thought he'd shanked it. You see the replay. It is, even just from 15 yards out, a perfectly, as you put it, AD, dinked goal. As a finish.
It just seemed to go in slow motion as well. It was just weird.
I mean, Jace, obviously you're at the far end from the stadium here, and I know the view's not great from where you are, but tell us about what you saw from it.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I had an absolutely terrible view because we were in the second layer of tickets, the second tier of ticket buying, and so we ended up at sort of the back in the corner. But I could see it, and the way that he finished it, AD's phrase is always with aplomb. he finished it with it, but more than that, it was clever. It was such a clever finish as the keepers came out, because there's not power on it, but there's just the right amount of chip and spin and bounce, and it was just beautiful. With his wrong foot as well. It's an absolute outrage to the post.
I just really feel for the guy.
Was I mean, out by basically incompetence.
Yeah, I just really feel for a guy because the last two times he's had the ball in the net, he's been wrongly ruled out by VAR.
And the one time he did get it in the net, it was an own goal.
Yeah, it was just really sad. But I mean, going back to his crossing ability, there just seems to be there's just a certain shape he puts to the ball, which is like a fizz and an angle to it. It just seems to be perfect. Not every time, obviously, because that would be making him a robot. But it's like it's just a delight to watch.
I think that's why they're so effective, because there is a fizz to the cross. To the crosses he puts in, there's always a nice sort of outward curve. So it's always, the ball's always seems to be approaching the player that is running onto it. So they're not having to like run. So it's not like it depends which way it is, but he swings it out from the goal, towards the goal. And that, so it just seems to, when the forward player does make contact, it tends to be a sweet one, which is why he does so well on the assists, because I just think it's just a decisive delivery of the ball that if you get on the end of it, then that's it, it's going in.
Well, this is it, at least
it's really, every really good.
It's every cross that at least gives the attacker a chance. I mean, the number of times, I mean, one, if I'm going to criticize anyone who crosses the ball a lot at the moment, I'd say that Tarik Lamptey's needs to be improving a little bit. Far too many are either hitting the first defender or being shanked. And I think that, you can rely on his stooping hands cross, I think, as much as you can rely on a Pascal Gross dead ball. Maybe, probably a little bit more than maybe a Solly March corner. Andy, you were closer to that. Tell us about it.
The
comedy one.
He literally... The only person more embarrassed would have been Roman Bednarak for his own goal.
Oh yeah, can we just talk about that, because that was brilliant. I mean, I was at Anfield in the FA Cup. I was watching Lewis dunk. That was worse than Lewis's there. But that's a nice segue actually, because I mean, one person that would have been glad to get out of Selhurst alive was, I mean, despite how poor Palace were, was Lewis Dunk. It's very rare you get him to see absolutely beasted by someone, and Mateta was giving him an absolutely torrid time, Jason.
He was, although I think towards the end, Mateta was getting quite frustrated, so I wouldn't have said that it lasted the entire game.
Yeah, because he got taken off after 70 minutes.
Point where we definitely noticed Mateta getting a little bit upset, shall we say.
Well, the thing is, I mean, Mateta was giving Dunk a hard time, but I think that Dunk was actually sort of giving it back. I mean, it's not as though you see Dunk win the vast majority of his headers. I mean, if you were going to look at the stats, I'd imagine that probably they each won the same amount, and there was a lot of jostling, and there was a lot of this and a lot of that. I think Mateta was getting frustrated because he was more and more an isolated figure. And it could have even been that Lewis Dunk was not even going to bother challenging because no one else was near him. No one else was near Mateta. He couldn't get his... that's what the game they were playing. That's the only game they could play. Get the ball forward as quickly as possible. And sometimes it was too quick and the fellow was isolated. I liken it to Glenn Murray playing up front on his own in the last days of Chris Hughton, where he had to... keep the ball, and he was never the best keeper of the ball in the first place. So,
you're not referring to that, that time against Arsenal where he got the ball and he would have been clean through a goal and he went backwards.
No, but there was lots of games towards the end of Houghton's tenure, you know, where the Albion were sort of considered a little bit too defensive. Murray was up front on his own and the ball would be hoofed up to him. Yes, he'd win the header, but then there's nothing else he could do with it because the rest of the team hadn't caught up. Thankfully, we don't play like that anymore, but weirdly enough, Palace still do.
Yeah, okay. I don't really think that you can say Mateta completely owned Dunk. When you look at over the overall of the game, they had one chance. Okay, it's Webster that blocked it, but they at no point did I think, blimey, Mateta's going to score any minute. I just didn't think.
He looked like a lump to me, just like a crude instrument, and I think that's why Palace have not lived up to the promise of what Vieira was doing last season, where they improved their style of football, and they seem to have gone backwards. They missed Wilf. Can you say? I mean, I just think the one player with a bit of craft about him. I thought Elise was very disappointing. I was kind of worried about him before the game, but he made one decent pass and that was it.
Yeah. Okay, well, I mean, we did only come out of Selhurst with just a solitary point. Obviously, the VAR controversy didn't help, but there was another incident in this game which did see Palace equalised. And I mean, I know that certain members of this parish, we're looking at you, Marcus, were particularly scathing.
It's one of those things that happens. It really is. It's just bad timing. Wrong opponents, wrong venue, wrong timing. Yeah, it's a perfect storm of dratism, but, you know, let's face it, he's still, for me, in the plus column. There isn't anything you can mitigate. I mean, yeah, people are coming away from that fuming, but to blame him and him alone for the draw is ridiculous. Yes, it was a dropsy. Yes, it was a howler, but you win as a team and you lose as a team. And if basically the forward players have put their chances away, we'd be talking about it in terms of, well, good job we were 5-0 up, but we weren't.
And I mean Sanchez is mostly in credit with us still. It was a terrible mistake, and we have noticed a few errors creeping in, maybe. Would you agree?
I don't know, because I know that you think that because you tell me every week. I tend to not agree with that point in general. I think Sanchez is okay. You know, it was a horrendous mistake. I mean, he was under no pressure whatsoever. I mean when Elise put the free kick in, I thought, what a terrible free kick, that's a joke. Be an easy take. It was horrendous, but I think Al is completely correct in saying, you know, if you're going to just single out that one element, it's completely unfair. I really like the way that the fans cheered his name at the end of the game when he sheepishly came over. I'm sure he wouldn't have felt too great about coming over, given how disappointed everybody was, and I'm sure he was feeling responsible for it. But actually, I thought our fans were great. They backed him. Even if they didn't mean it, they knew it would have meant something to him.
Yeah.
Which I thought was quality from our support. I thought the way that De Zerbi backed him up afterwards as well was excellent. I think, you know, Robert's got to learn from this. He knows it doesn't matter how quiet a game he is, like goalkeepers don't have the leeway that outfield players do.
Yeah. It's just concentration, right?
Yeah, it's just the way it is. And it's, you know, it might not seem fair to goalkeepers, but that, you know, that's football. You've got to be on it for every single second of the game. And hopefully he'll pick it up. And I think that will go through the entire team. I think that dressing room is going to be pretty, they're going to be just as irate as we are that we didn't win that. And I think, I think we're going to pay him back in a few weeks' time.
you're gagging for this, aren't you?
I cannot wait. I wish we were playing this game. I wish we were playing tomorrow.
Yeah, I wish we were playing them this Saturday instead of Fulham. without a doubt.
A couple of things as an addendum to what you said there, Andy. I mean, you're talking about De Zerbi's backed him, the fans have backed him. What you probably might not have seen at the time, and I made a point of looking at this, is a Lewis Dunk backed him as well. Just, you know, everyone else just walked away. He went back to him and sort of like held his hand out and said, look, you know, don't worry about it. Have you seen my career record? You know, so it's you've got that. But the other thing is that, you know, hey, Hugo Lloris did this at the Amex and he's played in two World Cup finals. So
he won one.
And won one of them, exactly. So in the great scheme of things, you know, he's in good company.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, well, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. This show is, as ever, brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com, and Phil has provided us with another mystery shirt for us to delight over. So who wants to have a go at describing this one?
It's a rugby shirt, isn't it?
It's about right.
Yeah,
that's about right.
No, I mean, it's hooped rather than striped, black and white.
Stripes are going wrong way.
Horrible sponsor. It just looks like a rugby shirt. It looks like what you put a fat bloke who plays hooker in the weekend for his local pub in. I don't know who it is. I don't really care. It's horrible.
So you're saying this is a Sunday League shirt for rugby players / football on Hackney Marshes?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Okay, right. Now then, Andy, could you describe it with a little less emotion?
Yeah, I think Jace is right. I think it does look like a rugby shirt, to be honest.
Can you at least still have a go at the badge?
But the badge seems to have what looks like a trig point on it. The badge is like a shield with an orange lower half with some kind of building or monument in it. And then what appears to be
it is a red lower half. I can confirm.
Oh, red lower half, and either another monument or trig point, and then we've got Rocket Sport as the logo with what appears to be Stevenson's rocket as the K, which is a rather nice graphic device. So I'm going to suggest that this is like a Northeast non-league team.
In which case, actually, I think that you've actually maybe sold this one to me as to who it might be. It's the word rocket. Is this Darlington?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, it is. Darlo. Well, this is what Phil has got to say about this particular shirt. And he says, our shirt of the week is the 1995-96 home shirt of the now defunct Darlington FC. Known as the Quakers, they were formed in 1883 and originally played their home games at Feetham's, which had a capacity of 8,500 for football matches, and rather unusually, 5,000 for cricket matches on the adjacent cricket pitch, used by, amongst others, Durham County Cricket Club. In 2003, they moved into a 25,000-seater Reynolds Arena, named after the chipboard tycoon George Reynolds, who wanted to get the club to the top flight. Sadly, the average crowds were around 2,000 and the club went into administration three times. And on the third occasion in 2012, there was no coming back and the club folded. A new club was formed, Darlington 1883, and they began life at the bottom of the pyramid, playing at an alternative ground, Blackwell Meadows, where they remain to this day. After three promotions in four seasons, the FA approved their request to rename the side Darlington FC, and they currently play in the Vanarama National League North. Notable former players include David Wheater, who made his name with the 140 games for Middlesbrough and 212 games for Bolton Wanderers, both during their halcyon days in the Premier League. Marco Gabbiadini was voted the Quakers' best ever player after his spell between 1998 and 2000, where he played 87 times and scored 47 goals. And of course, there's a couple of depressing Albion stories and a link. In September 1997, the Albion played Darlington at Priestfield, and after their goalie was sent off early on, their 5'10" striker, Carl Schutt, went in goal and he kept a clean sheet in the 0-0 draw. Darlington made up for it, thumping us 0-4 the following season in Gillingham, with Gabbiadini scoring three. And the link? Well, Dan Byrne began his career playing with Darlington between 2009 and 2011. So, of course, thank you very much for that, Phil. And, of course, you can see that and over 130,000 others over at oldfootballshirts.com, which is always a worthwhile visit. Right, Al.
Hello.
On Saturday afternoon, we came out of the ground and tried to interview some Japanese people.
Let me set the scene. Okay, so we AD and I are privileged enough that we have a couple of spaces in the press box, and we were parked right in between BBC Sussex on one side, so that's Johnny Cantor and Warren Aspinall, and BBC London on the other side. A chap called Kevin, I didn't catch his surname, and an ex-footballer next to him, whose name I also
Carl Mortimer.
Was that who it was?
Yep.
Okay, and obviously he's offering up a very much a London biased commentary in the same way that Johnny Cantor, clearly, you know, brilliant though he is, I think it's just part of the remit that you do favour your home turf side. Anyway, so we're having a chat. By the way, that reminds me, get well soon, Brian Owen. The man is a walking nightmare.
I shouldn't laugh really, but poor old Brian has broken.
No, don't laugh. It is. He's broken his ankle.
In very nondescript circumstances. But yeah, get well soon, Graham.
Of all things that's going to happen to is Brian Owen. Bloody hell. Anyway, so we're leaving the ground. I suspect that probably most people have gone. And I know all the way fans will have their stories of Kettling and what have you, and the police letting everyone through the station, what have you. By this time, it had quietened down. And there's a bunch of fans. They've got the barriers out on Holmesdale Road where the Albion coach is going to come down after they've done all their press details. To a man, the entire thing was, actually, tell a lie, I was going to say everyone was Japanese.
They really were not. In fact, actually, it wasn't them that I noticed at first, because there was
the Ecuadorians, wasn't it?
It was the Ecuadorians. There was a good 30 or 40 Ecuadorians there waiting for our Ecuadorian contingent to come through.
It was probably about 25, 30, but the point is that the rest of them, and we're talking about 150 here. Now, I think it's just an assumption on my part that it would be people over here who are either working for a Japanese company or maybe Japanese students who have come over to watch their hero, Kairi Mitoma. Not a bit of it. They've flown in just for the game. They have no real love and affinity for Brighton and Hove Albion, although they nominally call themselves Brighton fans because of Mitoma. And they are the only people, I'm sorry about this, you might want to cover your ears here, who are buying half and half scarves. They don't have within them any sort of real consideration of the rivalry. Yeah. They just want
Need to butt in here, Al, because, I mean, they were waiting for Carew to come through and sign autographs, and they'd been to the Palace shop, and he would have been using a Crystal Palace pen.
Which
bleeds fire.
When you go to the Amex, and I'm sure that you guys have noticed this, and I'll come to you, Jason. There's a lot more Japanese people at the Amex specifically for that reason. Once upon a time, we might have sniffed at the whole notion of football tourism, but it's rather fun, isn't it?
Well, I think it is. There's limitations within that fun, which I'll come on to. But we had two Japanese people right behind us for the Arsenal game.
Right.
And they were incredibly excited, and they were also incredibly disappointed when Mitoma's second goal was disallowed.
I think we all were, mate.
Where do you queue?
Yeah, go on. Sorry.
But they absolutely love him, and they are spending money to come over here and watch Brighton games and clean the club shop out of tap, basically. And fair play to them. I lived in Tokyo for a year.
I did,
and they're incredibly proud of their national heroes. There's a whole culture of national pride, basically. And he will be the fact that he's making headlines in the Premier League. That I'm sure there will be Japanese sections on the Japanese news of just him scoring for Brighton.
Yeah,
absolutely.
We see it in the press box everywhere we go. The amount of Japanese journalists that are coming over, and it is absolutely amazing, and it's wonderful to see. And it's like, I mean, and I do wonder.
It's also the place where Japan beat South Africa at rugby.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say. I do wonder whether the miracle of Brighton, as they called it in Japan, whether these people actually realise that, you know, they're watching their hero quite often in that exact same corner, also known as Buckley Corner.
Sorry, Jace, tell us about when you were in Tokyo. How long ago are we talking about here?
Quite a long time, 20 years ago, believe it or not, 2003.
Right, but the culture would be largely the same, irrespective of the fact that you've come home since you've come home. There's been, like you say, the miracle of Brighton with the cherry blossoms and Matoma tearing up the Premier League. So, do you have sort of still links back to Tokyo where you're talking to people saying, hey, what do you reckon about this, dot, dot, dot?
Not so much, because I was working with a bunch of expats, but certainly even 20 years ago, because of the World Cup, there was huge interest in the national team. Their games on TV were a really big event. I went out to Saitama to watch them play against South Korea in a friendly, and it was this massive, massive thing with people turning up early and drinking beer and all of that. They're definitely into it.
And they love their national dress as well, don't they? They really make the effort, and it's really quite the spectacle to see.
Absolutely, it absolutely is. We were also the Bournemouth game. Me and my son were going over from Brighton, having had a swift half in the local establishment.
Yes,
and there was a young Japanese boy with his parents in the seat across the aisle from us on the train, who got really, really, really excited the closer he got to the Amex. Although he did momentarily mistake the outdoor five-a-side 4G for the pointed the stadium out to him.
Is that it?
Yes.
Do you still speak any Japanese?
No, I could probably get from the airport to a hotel and order a beer, and that's it.
But back in a previous life, I was working for a well-known airline that used to sponsor Crystal Palace. They just started up the Tokyo route, and they actually offered us to pay us a load more money if we weren't had Japanese lessons. And so I, of course, signed up for this. Did not last very long at all, but I can say hello, goodbye, and hold on, I'll get you a Japanese speaker. That's pretty much all I can do.
That's fair enough. I mean, what you'll find actually also after the game at the Amex Club shop, I've said this before on recent Raws, is that you'll have those same Japanese people who obviously didn't get the chance before the game to go in the shop afterwards, and the number of people getting number 22 Matoma
it's none on home shirts because they sold out a long time ago.
Well, whatever they can get hold of, they're going for it. So I mean, it's great. I mean, additionally, Andy, we've got a fair pile of Ecuadorians coming along again. Is football tourism something you welcome?
Yeah, I love it. I think it's really fun. And I think they are bringing something to the club. Obviously, with the Ecuadorians, we've got Ronald Calante doing his marvelous vlogs. I particularly like his home videos because he always does like basically like a Brighton tourist board video before he heads up to the Amex. But I mean, these players are bringing something to the club. Obviously, you know, Matoma's a star, Caicedo's a star. We've got potential future stars like Sarmiento, Estupiñán's a star. They're all bringing something to it. Their fellow countrymen and fans are into it, and it just brings a load of positivity, a lot of smiles, a lot of good energy. I am all for it. I'm absolutely all for it.
I also think it's so important that we as Brighton fans, as old knackered Brighton fans, actually do make them feel welcome. I mean, like I say, I 100% agree with your outlook on that. Yeah, it's they bring a colour, they bring life, they bring energy. They bring enthusiasm without even bringing cynicism that the likes of us miserable sods, you know, have over 40 plus.
Never the cynicism, Al. That's the best bit. Okay, well, I mean, talking about football tourism, though, guys, Fulham visiting the Amex this weekend, and this is a game which has got a lot more on it than we would have thought at the beginning of the season, Jason.
Yes, it has. What's been astonishing this season, normally there's one side that will break that top six mould, you know, full stop. There's us, there's Fulham and there's Brentford, who are all capable of it this season. They gave us a very, very... I was at the game at Craven Cottage. They were far better than us. They deserved to win that game. I don't think we picked necessarily the best side. But...
Yeah, I mean, I think, Jason, that's the only game this season... I think that we've actually been outplayed.
Yeah, I would agree. And it's paramount that it doesn't happen on Saturday, because we're competing with them for a spot for Europe at the moment, and they're there completely on merit, I think. Silva's done a wonderful job with them. When you watch Mitrovic, he's so confidence. There's one bit against Forest on Saturday where he didn't score, but he sat half the Forest defence on their backsides at the same time.
But Willian's goal as well was just an absolute delight, wasn't it?
Yeah, he's been reinvigorated. I don't know. I heard he wasn't doing very well in Brazil, and so I had to sort of sneak back over here, but he's been fantastic for Fulham.
Don't know about you, Andy, but I'm dreading this one.
I'm looking forward to it, because I think it's, you know, it's a real middleweight clash. I wouldn't say heavyweight, because we're sixth and seventh, but it's kind of a really good middleweight contest between two teams that are upsetting the Premier League apple cart, really slugging it out for the opportunity to have a go at Spurs and Newcastle, to be honest. I think whoever wins this game will, if there is a winner, will fancy their chances of maybe clawing their way up one or two more spots. Certainly, if we can win this, it'll be huge. It'll take us a point behind Spurs.
Two games in hand.
With the game in hand. And it'll put us within a game of Newcastle, who we still have to play. And we have a game in hand on them as well. But as you know, Jason said, you know, we were, you know, as we've all said, we were outplayed at Craven Cottage. I don't think at the time our fans gave Fulham the right amount of credit for how well they pretty much combated us all over the pitch. Our players seem to be in the wrong place. Their players were all in the right place. One of the rare occasions I've seen Potter get completely outcoached. And as Jason said, Fulham are there on merit. They're a really good team. We have to take them really seriously. It's going to be a tough game, and yes, we should be dreading it from the fact that our opponent is going to be a good quality opponent, but I'm looking forward to it because it's a massive game.
Well, it is certainly going to be an enticing battle, and hopefully that we can come out on top, and we'll be here celebrating next week. So all there is to say is thank you to Alan Wares. Thank you to Jason Thackeray. Thank you to Andy Bass. I've been Ailey Packham. This has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast and in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you all again next week. Bye.